Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The municipal bond market is the very opposite of sexy finance. It's how we pay for local police departments and highway repairs. And that is why it's kind of a problem that munis aren't doing so well. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact Email Marketing, providing small businesses and nonprofits with personal coaches to help them succeed. ConstantContact.com. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and Progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Friday, everybody. It's the 14th of January today. Most of the time when you're talking about the bond market, it's as a leading indicator. Bonds are a pretty good way to tell which way the economy is going by telling us how expensive it is to borrow money. The muni market, though, municipal bonds, are thoroughly lagging at the moment. Two-something years after the financial crisis, worries about budget deficits have borrowing costs for local governments back up where they were in the dark days of early 2009. From New York, Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
The last couple years have been boom time for bonds. The municipal bond market grew to nearly $3 trillion. Bond analyst Marilyn Cohen says nobody seemed to care that many cities and states were in pretty bad financial shape.
I called it a Teflon bond market. It didn't matter what the bad news was. The buying power was insatiable. And then we hit a wall in November.
Namely, elections, where budget deficits took center stage.
The unfunded pension liabilities, the spending with abandon. All of a sudden, it seemed like investors got it and said, I better get out of Dodge. And of course, Dodge was the muni bond market.
This comes at a time when cities and states desperately need cash from that market. Yesterday, New Jersey had planned to issue $2 billion worth of bonds, but only ended up issuing about half that. Andy Pratt is with the New Jersey Treasury.
No one was buying municipal bonds yesterday. And in the end, we decided that rather than raise interest rates on them to a very high point, maybe finish it up later when the market's in better condition.
That could be a while. In the meantime, on top of regular funding needs, local governments have to refinance billions of dollars of short-term debt they took on during the financial crisis. Again, New Jersey's Andy Pratt.
We'll bide our time, we'll go forward, and we'll try to do it again. New Jersey is a good credit risk, and we're going to pay our bills.
Investors are paying attention to whether states can get their financial houses in order. After Illinois voted to raise taxes on Tuesday, their bond prices got a bump. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
If you've ever bought an airline ticket online, and by now that is probably most of us, you've used the services of a company called ITA. It supplies airline pricing and scheduling information to most of the big travel websites. I told you that as a way to set up this. There's word today that the U.S. Justice Department is taking a long, hard look at Google's plan to buy ITA. By now, Google is no stranger to working with government lawyers. Kind of comes with being Google. But Marketplace's Steve Henn explains attention from regulators in Washington is costing that big company big business.
Last year, Google bought more companies than any other firm in the United States. But buying its way into new markets is getting harder. Just look at the reaction to Google's attempt to purchase ITA, a travel data firm that most people have never heard of. Pamela Harbor-Jones is a former FTC commissioner.
Google could manipulate the marketplace. They could place their own travel search results at the top of every page after a search query.
Google is the internet giant everyone's afraid of. So Microsoft, Travelocity, and others launched an intense lobbying campaign to quash the ITA deal. Greg Sterling is an internet analyst at Opus Research.
Google is going to attract scrutiny in high-profile cases where it's trying to buy market leaders or high-dollar value deals.
This isn't new, but it is making more companies think twice before doing a deal with Google. Today, companies that Google tries to buy routinely demand huge kill fees that guarantee big payments, even if regulators in Washington quash a merger. Last year, AdMob demanded a $700 million kill fee on a $750 million deal. Groupon, the social shopping site, wanted a multi-billion-dollar guarantee before it would agree to a $6 billion Google takeover. That demand killed the deal instead, long before regulators ever got involved. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
So back to airplanes. After you bought those airline tickets online and then got on the plane, you discovered those planes are fuller than ever, right? The government's considering new rules that airlines would have to follow on flights that are overbooked, rules about bumping people off those planes involuntarily. But Delta Airlines is trying to get out ahead of the feds with a silent auction of sorts, passengers bidding on what it would take for them to voluntarily give up their seats. From New York, here's Marketplace's Janet Babin.
No, it's not your imagination. More of us are getting bumped off flights, especially if we book cheap seats or pay in frequent flyer miles. MIT Aeronautics Professor John Hansman says the airlines have increased passengers on flights.
10 years ago, they would only book about 70% of the seats. Today, the number is closer to 82-83%.
The more people booked, the more who show up, the more flights are overbooked. Delta has a new solution. Ask people what they'd be willing to pay to step off a flight. Delta spokesman Paul Skirbeck says when people check in, online or at the gate, they're now asked whether they'd be willing to rebook a later flight, and if so, how much they'd require Delta to pay them in the form of a voucher. Airline consultant Craig Jenks says Delta's silent bidding system could make for happier passengers.
The really good thing about it is that it should reduce to zero involuntary bumping.
Jenks says other airlines will likely follow Delta's lead. But Kate Hanai with FlyersRights.org says a silent auction is deceptive. She says the airlines should do this out in the open.
At the point they're at the gate, if there's an open auction or they continue to increase the amount that they offer.
The government recently doubled the compensation passengers are entitled to when they're rebooked on a later flight. So how much should your starting bid be? $400. That's what the government says if you're bumped off most domestic flights. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
A good day for banks on Wall Street, about which you'll hear more in just a moment. That helped the major indices higher today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We like to do this thing every Friday we call our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. What happened over the past 5 days that maybe we didn't get to cover elsewhere or while it was happening? Here to help us do that are Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, also John Carney from CNBC, where he runs the blog NetNet. Lee, John, good to talk to you both again.
Good to be here, Kai.
Thanks for having us.
I wanted to start with banks, mostly because J.P. Morgan came out this morning and said it made yet again $1 zillion, mostly by setting aside less money for losses, which is worth a mention. But, John, this idea that we're starting to see now of banks paying dividends to their shareholders once again, does that matter?
It matters a lot if you're a if you're a bank shareholder. With all the banks paying out large dividends, which is what everybody expects to happen in the future, one of the things they're not doing is accumulating bigger capital cushions. The Basel Committee gave them years and years to do this. The bank said, you know, oh, don't make us build up capital too quickly. But it turns out that they are building up capital very quickly. But what they're deciding to do is pay that out in dividends and in bonuses to their people.
So what are they doing? Are they currying favor with shareholders and the markets?
Yes. What they want to do is have their share prices go up. You know, the executives themselves hold lots and lots of shares in their own bank so that they get rich when that happens. And they want to be able to use their equity for things like acquisitions. So rather than, you know, accumulating this money, reserving against bad loans in the future, they want to pay the money out. And that's what's happening.
I mean, why bother reserving against bad loans in the future when you know the government's going to come in and help anytime you face a crisis?
And Basel gave them a decade to build up these liquidity and capital cushions that everybody agrees they need. And they said, no, we cannot get that money quicker than sometime in 2022 or something. Now it turns out, oh, they've got plenty of money.
Well, you have now said the words that make me change topics, Basel III, so we're not going to dwell on that anymore. Lee, you know, the chairman of the Fed, Ben Bernanke, came out this week and he said, you know, the economy's getting better. We're seeing more sales. There's more business, but we are not getting more jobs.
It's true. I mean, things are actually getting incrementally better a little bit at a time, a very little bit at a time. We are moving in the right direction. But you just can't forget that the jobs crisis we have is epic. It's unlike anything we've seen in a generation. So it's not going to happen overnight. And, you know, so even if things start to get better, it doesn't mean we're out of a crisis.
John, weigh in here.
I think that one of the things we've discovered is that a lot of the jobs that existed during the boom may never really have been all that productive to begin with. And so expecting them to just come back might be a mistake. What we're going to need is to create jobs in new fields, and we're going to have to be very innovative. We're not going to just be able to put people back to work in the way that they used to do, because a lot of those jobs probably should have gone away years and years before they actually did.
Well, you know, on that topic, John, of where the jobs are going, the president of China's in town next week. He meets with the president. There's a state dinner, high-level talks, all that stuff. What can really happen, though, on this trip that might balance out the economic equation there?
Nothing at all. China is going to be selling us stuff for a long time, and we just have to get used to that.
Well, David Leonhard had a great comment in his blog at the New York Times today that basically said we overstate the Chinese threat.
You know, there is a growing body of thought that says that's the case, or says that China's growth may be overheating and it may be headed for some massive slowdown. I mean, one thing we're seeing already is that inflation is becoming a problem in China, and that, of course, makes our currency more competitive, which, you know, starts to eliminate one of the major tensions between our economies. But, you know, it's definitely a force to be reckoned with, and it's definitely a delicate balance, to say the least.
Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine, John Carney from CNBC. Thanks a lot, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks for having us.
You heard Lee Gallagher a minute ago putting bank profits into context. Why set aside more for losses when you know there's a bailout coming? Too big to fail is another way of saying that. And it seems we're back to the same question we were bumping up against in the middle of the financial crisis. What exactly is too big to fail? Next week, a new government panel is supposed to come up with a list of what are called systemically important financial institutions. Here's the thing, though. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, the guy who's going to head that panel, wonders whether coming up with that list is even possible. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
The reforms pushed through the last Congress by Democrats Christopher Dodd and Barney Frank envision tighter regulation of institutions deemed vital to the financial system. The law leaves it up to regulators to actually identify those special cases, and Christopher Whalen of Institutional Risk Analytics says therein lies the dubious rub.
Congress mandated to the regulators that they should prevent systemic risk. But that's just not a reasonable request.
Treasury Secretary Geithner apparently agrees. He's quoted in a federal inspector general's report as saying, identifying risk depends too much on the state of the world at the time. And he adds, you won't be able to make a judgment about what's systemic and what's not until you know the nature of the shock. But like it or not, the new law requires some kind of definition, according to Karen Petru of Federal Financial Analytics.
He has little discretion. He has to name names. The law requires that that be done.
Petru isn't expecting a long list from Geithner's task force, but a focus on the most visible financial giants.
It's like, you know, the Supreme Court's decision that you can't define obscenity, you know it when you see it. And I think this is going to be the same test for systemic risk. You know it when you see it in its most obvious form, say a Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the very biggest of the big. And those are the first firms that are going to be named.
Which, Christopher Whalen says, still leaves our financial future uncertain.
Particularly when you're talking about the interaction in a still reasonably free market where you do have unanticipated events, you're always going to have the possibility of a meltdown.
Whalen says the government can try to impose safeguards, but he says Geithner is simply pointing out the government can't predict whether financial institutions will do something stupid in the future. And Whalen argues that uncertainty has always been vital to maintaining a healthy free market. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace. We'll be right back.
Coming up, hey, you looking for a new workout?
Basically, you do your yoga positions and Pilates-type positions while you're hanging from this hammock.
I don't know. Whatever happened to just going out for a run? Anyway, first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials bounced 55 points today, nearly a half percent, capped the week at 11,787. The NASDAQ Composite grew 20 points, 0.75%, wrapped up trading at 2755. The S&P 500 tacked on 9 points, 0.75%, closed at 1293. For the week, the Dow ended up 1%. The NASDAQ advanced nearly 2%. The S&P 500 rose 1.7% since Monday. Just for the record, it was the seventh positive week in a row for the S&P 500. You might want to keep this in mind for next week. The S&P hasn't had 8 straight winning weeks since January of 2004. Encouraging results from JPMorgan Chase beefed up the financial sector. Stock in Bank of America surged 3.25% today. Wells Fargo hitched up more than 2.5%. Citigroup shares deposited a gain of 1.75%. Bond prices slipped as investors chose stocks. The yield on the 10-year T-note nudged higher. 3.32% is the number. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Yellow Book 360, offering a spectrum of marketing tools for small businesses designed to go beyond yellow. More at yellowbook360.com. By the all-new Chevrolet Volt, available soon in select markets. Details at chevyvolt.com. The all-new Chevrolet Volt. It's more car than electric. And by Reputation Defender, monitoring, protecting, and helping improve your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Oh, hey, Monday is a holiday. Markets are closed in honor of Martin Luther King Day. On TV, it's the debut of Piers Morgan Tonight. Who's Piers Morgan? You can find him where you used to find Larry King on CNN. And he's currently starring in Driving Miss Daisy on Broadway. Other credits include the voice of Darth Vader in Star Wars. James Earl Jones turns 80. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There's talk of a trade war brewing in the North Atlantic. The topic at hand is fish, mackerel specifically. Iceland has been catching boatloads of them, far beyond what the European Union believes is good for the conservation of the species. The EU has been demanding Iceland cut its quota for weeks now. Today, enough was enough. The EU simply said that Icelandic mackerel boats can't pull into any EU ports of call. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has more now on the mackerel wars.
Down on its luck with its banking industry bust, Iceland's had one recent stroke of good fortune. Millions of mackerel have chosen to swim north into the country's territorial waters. Dragana Ignatovic is with IHS Global Insight.
Iceland is getting more mackerel. It's as simple as that. So they feel that they should be able to fish it, given that it's in their waters.
And they have been fishing it, landing some 143,000 tonnes last year. EU demands that Iceland ease up on the mackerel have touched a raw nerve. Icelanders see this almost as a matter of their own survival.
This is about standing firm and not giving in.
Spokesman for Iceland's fishing industry, Siggi Severison.
We feel that we do have the right to fish for a fair share of the mackerel.
But what's a fair share of mackerel for Iceland? Opinions vary. The EU reckons about 22,000 tonnes this year. Iceland wants 160,000. Magnus Arni Skulason of Reykjavik Economics.
Fish is very important. We need the foreign reserves, foreign exchange, to be able to repay foreign creditors.
Fish accounts for 60% of Iceland's exports. It is, says Magnus, the country's most valuable asset by far, and he bridles at EU allegations of overfishing.
If we would overfish, we would basically be, taking the principal out of the bank, reducing the principal of the capital that is in the sea.
If overall mackerel stocks decline, he says that's because of overfishing in EU waters. The escalating war over mackerel won't enhance Iceland's chances of joining the European Union. The bid for membership was launched in the wake of Iceland's financial meltdown.
After their economy crashed 2.5 years ago, many people felt that perhaps they would be better off belonging to the EU.
Jon Danielsson of the London School of Economics, he says now Europe's debt crisis is making many Icelanders think again.
As the situation in Iceland has recovered quite significantly since the crash, while the EU economic situation is becoming steadily worse, the EU is seen as a lot less attractive opportunity than it was at the time.
He says the mackerel spat has raised fresh fears about joining the EU and allowing Brussels to take control of Iceland's most precious resource, its waters. Many Icelanders feel that as a small nation they'd be bullied by larger member states. Many now seem to feel Iceland would be better off as a big fish in its own small pond. This is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This being January, the month when New Year's resolutions have not yet had a chance to be forsaken, there's a whole slew of people newly devoted to getting in shape out there. In New York City, there's no shortage of places to work out, which is why gyms there are offering all sorts of new fitness classes. And some of those classes, well, they're a little bit out there. Joanna Robledo has spent the past month trying the new fitness fad. She wrote about it in this week's issue of New York Magazine. Joanna, good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
Now, you are an exerciser, right? But you're not one of these fitness trend chasers, are you?
No, not at all. I'm actually a runner. And prior to doing this article, that's pretty much all I did, unless, you know, it was too cold out.
Yeah. So tell me about these classes. What are they like just in general for those of us who haven't been to a gym in years?
You know, it's amazing. I expected something of the Jane Fonda ilk, and I was amazed to see the breadth and depth of variety out there. There's everything from a boot camp style class to a cheerleading class to a samurai sword class where we were pretty much holding on to samurai swords the entire time to Bollywood dance, complete with a wonderfully lyrical narrative going along every single move you made.
Tell me about that boot camp one. You called it boot camp meets Jeopardy. I don't quite understand how that works.
Basically, I call it boot camp because you're working as if you'd imagine, you know, people in the military would train. You're doing jumping jacks, push-ups. But the Jeopardy element comes in where you sit in teams and you have to answer trivia questions. And depending on whether you get it right or wrong, you get hard exercises or extra hard exercises.
So there's no easy exercise option?
No. Unfortunately not.
There was a picture that went along with this article that I have to ask you about. People are hanging from what look like long ropes upside down in a gym someplace. What is that one?
They call that float. And it's basically yoga meets aerial aerobics meets Pink at the Grammys because she was hanging up from the rafters. And basically, you do your yoga positions and Pilates-type positions while you're hanging from this hammock. And they call it a hammock, actually, although it looks more like a sling.
This is ultimately a business story, though, isn't it? I mean, gyms are doing whatever it takes at the tail end of a recession and the beginning of a new year to get new customers in the door.
I mean, there are plenty of gyms in a city. You can only do so much in terms of how to beautify your space. Everyone can get the same gym equipment. You can always compete on price. So how do you differentiate yourself? You offer classes that are unusual and different and fun, and that would be a great lure. And hopefully you help people exercise and get fit at the same time.
It's not cheap to get into some of these classes, especially in a place like Manhattan.
No, not at all. You pay anywhere from $80 to $200 for a membership every month.
What about yourself? Are you a convert now, or are you just going to keep on running when the weather's nice?
I have to admit, after doing the month of classes, I went back to my running. Although, yes, I have gone in the last 3 weeks now to at least one exercise class a week.
Joanna Robledo is a contributing editor at New York Magazine. In this week's issue, she is the gym class guinea pig. We've got a slideshow on our website of some of the crazy things that gyms are doing to get people in the door these days. Joanna, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot.
Marketplace is supported by Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at novonordisk-us.com. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a way to slide into the weekend on the lighter side with some of the news that didn't quite make the headlines, courtesy of Brendan Francis Noonan, Rico Galliano, and the rest of the Marketplace staff.
Delasi Michalis, web developer for Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Dwayne Reed, a division of Walgreens, just opened up a new place in a hip artsy neighborhood in Brooklyn. And they were a little bit worried folks wouldn't like them because those folks like their local pharmacies.
And so have they been shunned?
No, actually they've been well embraced because Dwayne Reed decided to sell fancy draft beer in the drugstore.
That's all it took to placate them was beer?
Yeah, you think they'd at least hold out for a skinny jeans tailor or something.
John Haas, editor, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
A guy gets kicked out of a bar in Germany and stabs the doorman 3 times on his way out.
Great story.
Well, there is good news. The bouncer actually came away unscathed because he had a wallet in his breast pocket. It was stuffed with credit cards and...
There were enough cards to survive a knife attack?
He had a total of 20 cards. Most of them were video rental cards. It's as if he hadn't cleaned out his wallet since 2003.
Man, but that's a good argument for clinging to outmoded forms of media.
Yeah.
Adrian Hill, reporter for Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
I'm going to be talking about Chat Roulette, which, if you remember, is the website where you see a live video feed of random strangers from around the world.
But then it became a magnet for men who wanted to expose themselves.
There was naked everywhere on Chat Roulette, and basically they realized they can turn it into money.
I'm afraid to ask, how?
Well, they basically have a system where people can flag any other people who are getting a little too naked online. And if you get flagged enough, they send you to an adult partner site, and Chat Roulette actually gets paid for each referral. So right now they're making $100,000 a month off all these naked men.
I can't believe it.
Super clever, right?
No, I can't believe they're making this much money off of me.
Oh, Brendan. That is just the tiniest taste of what Rico and Brendan have to offer. Their podcast is called Dinner Party Download, and the link is on our website. It's marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace, the radio show from American Public Media. Today, the Dow advanced 55 points, nearly a half percent. The NASDAQ climbed 20 points, 0.75%. The S&P 500 added 9 points, also 0.75%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is JJ Yule. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, how much investment risk are you prepared to take? Well, kind of depends on how you think about it, I guess.
Imagine if you went to a dentist and the dentist said, we want to use the least amount of Novocaine possible. So you tell me what you think the most pain you can take is and we'll go from there.
Oh, no. No. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are back here on Monday, dentist free. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.